Okay, we can see from figure 7.7 that the hydrogen molecule ion is a bound state because the graph dips below minus 1, so there's an energy less than that of neutral hydrogen atom and a free proton. I'm confused about the driving frequency and the transition frequency. Can you define what they represent in terms of the sinusoidal perturbation example in the book? Let's do a simpler one first. Do you have someone on a swing and you push them? You push them at some frequency, right? Once a second, once every 2 seconds. Push on the swing is the driving frequency. The swing has its own oscillation frequency. That's like the transition frequency. So in our two-state problem, there's an energy difference between the two states. And if you take out an H bar, that means there's a frequency difference between them. So that's the natural frequency of the oscillation between the two states. The driving frequency is the frequency of the perturbation. So in the sinusoid, in the sinusoidal perturbation, it has some time dependence with an omega in it. That's the driving frequency. That's what you're pushing on it with. Is the reason that the transition probability never reaches 1 due to some uncertainty principle, or is it just a mathematical result? It's due to the fact that probabilities can't be bigger than 1. So we ask for the probability that the state starts in state A and ends up in state B at some later time. The probability of that can't be bigger than 1. The world would be an interesting place if probabilities were bigger than 1. Much more interesting than it is.
Let's just say it never reaches.
What?
It never gets to 1. It's always less than 1.
I think he meant less than or equal to 1. I think in the problem they find the exact answer. So in the exact answer, I think you see that it goes to 1 and then comes back down. It's allowed to go to 1. What does good state mean? So the good states are the states that diagonalize the perturbation Hamiltonian. They're good because they make our life easy, because the matrix is already diagonal in that basis. Is the two-level system perturbation a good approximation for electron jumps in an atom? Yes. And we're going to calculate electrons jumping between levels in an atom using this time-dependent perturbation theory. What is a physical example with a sinusoidal perturbation?
Light.
You guys are taking EM. Using what we've learned so far, is there a way to determine what an allowed electron transition is and how to determine what it will take for a forbidden transition to occur? Yes. And later on in the chapter, it goes through that, and we're going to do some of that. But the allowed transitions are the transitions where the dipole transitions can make the transition for you. So we already calculated dipole matrix elements when we did the Stark effect, when we had the atom in a constant electric field. Now we're going to let that electric field oscillate in time. So yes, we can work it out, but we'll do it in more detail later. Why is the variational principle an overestimate of the ground state energy? So with our arbitrary wave function, we showed that the expectation value for an arbitrary wave function of the Hamiltonian is bigger than the ground state energy. So if we just randomly guess a wave function, we'll always get something bigger. So unless we guess the exact form of the ground state wave function, we'll get something bigger than that. So it's an overestimate. How do quantum jumps work? Where does the energy to transition come from? So energy is conserved. So if something makes a jump, if it jumps up to a higher energy, it had to absorb some energy from something outside of the atom. If it jumps down to a lower energy, it has to emit that energy. Usually it does that by emitting a photon. But it can absorb the energy from a photon coming in or from some collision with another atom. but it comes from, we pretended that there was only one hydrogen atom in the universe and solved that problem. In reality, there's other stuff going on, and it can get energy from the surroundings. Are we looking at tunneling chapter 8, or are we skipping it? We're skipping it. Because when I tried to do chapter 8 one time, all the students thought the math was way too hard. So if you guys think this math is hard, they claimed that that was even harder. But it's also really interesting, so if I were you, I would read that chapter, because it's really cool. I'm a bit unsure as to what physical systems the time-dependent perturbation theory is useful for. So as we mentioned earlier, light, radio waves. But in general, movies are more interesting than staring at still pictures. So doing experiments where there's some time dependence are more interesting than experiments where nothing, everything is just static. So life is about change, so it's useful for that. Why is the time-dependent part of the Hamiltonian small compared to the time-independent part? Well, we're assuming it's small, otherwise we can't do perturbation theory. If it's not small, then you have to do some other fancier technique that's even harder. So this is the simplest possible case. If quantum jumps allow transitions between one energy level to another, how significant are these changes in the system? So I'm not sure I understand this question, but it's this time-dependent perturbation theory that allows us to understand the quantum jumps. So these transitions we're talking about are the quantum jumps. And the quantum jumps are interesting because that means something's happening. If it was just, if everything was just an exact eigenstate of the Hamiltonian and nothing ever changed, I mean, everything would be in the ground state or in some particular energy state and nothing would ever happen. So it's important. I'm unclear on what physical information I should be getting from the exchange integral and the direct integral. So remember, the direct integral was something like this. And the exchange integral was something like so this is the direct integral because the perturbation, this is the Coulomb attraction to the second proton. This is an electron sitting around one proton and is feeling the effect of a Coulomb attraction from the other proton. In this case, there's a transition. We're going from proton 1 to proton 2, or vice versa, from a perturbation. So this is telling you that the electron is effectively jumping from one proton to the other. That's what this perturbation is allowing it to do. And when we solve for the wave function, we saw that most of the time the electron spends its time in the middle. So it's not sitting around one or the other. It spends its time jumping back and forth, if you want to think about it semi-classically. So that's why it's called the exchange term. So, time dependence. Excitement. Couldn't get excited if there wasn't time dependence. You'd always be bored. So we have let's take a two-level system where we know the energy eigenvalues. They're EA and EB, Psi A and Psi B. And we've cleverly solved for the wave functions and made them orthonormal. So the general solution, the most general solution, it's just some linear combination of these two guys, because there's only two possible states. means if we take a linear combination of states with two different energies, they have different time dependence. One goes with e to the minus EAT over h bar. The other one has an e to the minus IEDT over h bar. So it's this time dependence that allows them, tells you that they're solutions of the time dependent Schrodinger equation. So h acting on this thing is equal to I h bar d by dt acting on the same wave function. So h gives you a factor of b, and d by dt brings down a factor of b. So now we're going to add a time dependent perturbation to that. Oh, since probability is conserved, we can normalize things so the sum of the squares of those coefficients equals to 1. So that's the most general possible wave function that you can get for a two-state system. The end. Now let's tickle it with some time-dependent perturbation. So we give it a little push. And the push happens either the simplest cases where it's sinusoidal, so the equations are easy to solve, but with some time dependence. So now our new Hamiltonian is the original Hamiltonian plus this time dependent perturbation. And our, well, we'll just put a T, make these coefficients functions of time. There's still only two states. So this Hamiltonian, the unperturbed Hamiltonian has some, gives us some spatial wave functions. So if we put in some time dependence, the most general thing that can happen is that those coefficients become time dependent. So we'll just plug that solution into the Schrodinger equation. So H acting on that wave function with time-dependent coefficients. The H naught will just give us the energy of that state. H prime will give us whatever H prime acting on that wave function gives us. Depends on the form of H prime. On the right hand side, IH bar times the time derivative. So now we'll get time derivatives of coefficients, since they're time dependent, and derivatives from the exponential. So we'll call the time derivative, we'll put a dot for time derivative. Time derivative acting on the exponential brings down a minus I e over h bar. So now Now, these terms are just what we had for our unperturbed system. So, they just cancel each other. If we take an inner product of this with a bra psi A, then we'll only pick out the terms with psi A. Inner product with psi B will be zero. So we'll get psi A H prime psi A here. H prime acting on psi b is some other linear combination of psi a and psi b, so we don't know that this vanishes, even though psi a, psi b inner product vanishes. Save space, we'll just write these matrix elements like they were a matrix. So if I write H prime IJ, it's a matrix element with psi I in the bra and psi J in the ket. So we can solve this equation for CA dot. Put CA dot on the left and move everything else to the right. So to do that, we multiply through by e to the plus I EAT over H bar. That removed that from these terms. And then in the CB term, let's skip a step. There's no CB. Product with psi A. So that was the whole point of taking the inner product, was to get rid of this term. Okay, so this term is gone. We multiplied through by an exponential with a plus sign to remove this and this. And so here we got the difference. And then we could go back and take an inner product with psi b. We'd get the same kind of equation, a and b interchanged. Now we'll make another simplifying assumption, because, well, solve that. Not so easy. So it's even simpler if the diagonal elements of the perturbation matrix are zero, which when we study light interacting with atoms, it's going to be the case. And we can define some omega naught, which is the energy difference divided by h bar. So that's the transition frequency. That's the natural oscillation frequency of our system. So then we get some simple formulas. So suppose we're interested in the case where at some time that we'll call t equals zero, we know that it starts in the state psi A. So that means psi A equals zero, psi B, psi A equals one, psi B equals zero, at t equals zero. This is telling us the probability of finding it in state A at t equals zero is one. Probability of finding in B is zero. So if H prime is really a small perturbation, then zeroth order approximation is that it's just this. Zeroth order, this is already first order in H prime. So zeroth order, that would be our approximation. It's good for small enough times, like t equals zero. First order, we'll get CA dot is minus I over H bar, H prime AB, e to the minus I omega naught T. We'll plug in on the right-hand side our zeroth order approximation for CB. So the first order, CA dot is zero. So the solution is still that CA equals one. What about CB? So CB dot is minus I over H bar, H prime BA e to the plus I omega naught T. And we put in our zeroth order solution for CA. Put superscripts up here to keep track of the order we're looking at. So our zeroth order solution was that this is 1. So now we can just solve that equation. So CB1 is just integrate that from time t equals 0 to whatever time we're interested in. Time t prime. Now to actually do the integral, we need to know what this matrix element is. But we must have known what h prime was, otherwise we would have started doing the problem. So we could calculate that, make the matrix elements, then do this integral. Get our first order approximation, then we can go to second order. So we put into the second order equation our first order approximation for CB. And now we can solve that by integrating. And we know that there's, so here there was a integration constant, but we know when t equals 0, this guy is 0, so that integration constant is plus 0. So it agrees with what we already know, that it vanished at t equals 0. At t equals 0, CA was 1. So we know the integration constant is 1. So now we have two time integrations to do. So change this guy to t double prime. So we can call the new one t prime. Or you can do it the other way if you want. So in principle, we can keep going on and on and on. But in, at least in this course, we're only going to do sinusoidal perturbations. So let's make it even more specific. Suppose perturbation Hamiltonian in some position-dependent potential times cos omega t. Then we can write our matrix element. It's the matrix element of the potential times cos omega t. And we'll assume that the diagonal elements vanish again, which is going to be the case when we consider light interacting with hydrogen atom. So now, in our first order calculation, this is dBA cos omega t prime. Plugging in what the assumed form of our perturbation was. So now we can actually do the integration. So we'll write this exponential. Alright, this cosine is the sum of exponentials. So that's e to the I omega t prime plus e to the minus I omega t prime. So we can combine these as omega plus omega naught t. One term will have the sum of frequencies and one will have the difference. And then even I can integrate an exponential. Just get 1 over the coefficient of the time in the exponential. So when we take this between 0 and t, we'll get e to the the I, omega naught plus omega t minus 1. And we can cancel these I's. Down here we have omega plus omega. So the case we're actually interested in is when these two frequencies are similar. And the reason for that is that when these two frequencies are similar, this difference is small, so 1 over it is big. That means this one is much bigger than this one. If you go back to our pushing the swing analogy, if you time your pushes correctly near the resonant frequency, then the amplitudes of the swing oscillation grow. If you push at the wrong time, off the frequency, then your kid yells at you because you don't even know how to push a swing. So everyone knows how to push a swing. You push it at the resonant frequency. Same thing here. We're interested in when we're close to the resonant frequency. So, near the resonant frequency, omega naught plus omega is much bigger than omega naught minus omega. Absolute value. So this coefficient CB is approximately given by just that second term. So we're going to do a fancy trick. We'll factor out e to the I omega naught minus omega times t over 2. And then we can write this thing up here more symmetrically. And then we did that because we like sine and cosines better than exponentials. Because we learned about sine and cosine in grade 8 and exponentials in grade 10. What grade did you learn about exponentials in?
Complex exponentials?
Yeah.
Okay. Public school. I didn't learn about it until
okay.
13.
But you did learn about sine and cosine in high school. So they're good. So the other reason why this is nice is now there's some real function times a phase. So when we calculate a probability, the phase will just cancel out because we take the modulus squared. So the real information is in this sign. So if we calculate the probability of starting in state A and going to state B of time t, it's CB of t squared. So it goes like the matrix element squared for h bar squared sine squared of omega naught minus omega t over 2 divided by omega naught minus omega squared. Should be a pretty picture coming out. The projector ever warms up. So, as a function of time, our transition probability is starts at zero because that was our initial condition. We said at t equals zero, it was in state A. So the probability of finding it in state B is zero. Then we calculated that there's a probability to find it in state B that varies sine, like a sine squared. So it goes up, and then after some time, it oscillates back down. Yeah.
How does it go from state A to B and back?
Because we kicked it.
So, okay, so you kicked it against the wall and it bounced back at you?
No. There, we jiggled it with some perturbation. The size of the perturbation is measured by this matrix element, VAB. Perturbation can induce a transition from state A to B. That's what that matrix element is telling us.
Does the same perturbation cause it to go from A to B and back to A?
Yes, because modulus VAB squared is the same as modulus VBA squared. Right? The thing that the matrix element that takes us from A to B is the complex conjugate of the matrix element that takes us from B to A. So the we started jiggling it so it would go to state B, but because of the sinusoidal variation, it comes back.
In reality, is there some kind of like decay?
We're going to get to decays. Right now, we're just driving it with this. We're looking at what happens when we drive it with a sinusoidal perturbation. So here is the same thing as a function of frequency, but moving in time. So what we're supposed to see here is that, let's start at t equals zero. At t equals zero, the probability is zero, and then it builds up near the resonant frequency. The amplitude is much bigger near the resonant frequency than anywhere else. And as time goes on, the probability at the resonant frequency, we have a much bigger probability, and that also this thing is narrowing in. And eventually, this probability is getting so big that our perturbation theory is breaking down. But in the textbook, he shows you how to get the exact solution in a problem to check that the probability never exceeds 1. So are there any questions about what this all means? So the transition probabilities are much bigger if our frequency is near the resonant frequency. And as time goes on, that probability increases.
You explain why is that?
Why it increases with time?
No, why it's bigger in the resonant part?
Because we got this sine of omega, omega naught minus omega over omega naught minus omega squared. So that function has a peak at zero and then goes down. But it's the same as the swing problem. If you perturb the swing at the resonant frequency, the amplitudes build up. If you push when the kid is at the bottom instead of when they're at the peak, then at some random, if you push at random times, the amplitudes of the swing won't build up. But the amplitude of the swing oscillation builds up if you push at the right times at the resonant frequency. Favorite source of sinusoidal perturbations is light or electromagnetic waves. So if you think about visible light, wavelengths are like 5,000 angstroms. But the size of an atom is 1 angstrom. And we know this, we know why this is, at least the light that interacts with hydrogen, we calculated its energies. The energies go like alpha squared. So that energy, those energy differences control how much energy is coming in or out if we absorb or emit a photon. So the wavelength goes like 1 over alpha squared. But the size of the hydrogen atom goes like 1 over alpha. So these have to be much bigger than the size of the atom. Just from, we did that in chapter 4. That was that Rydberg formula. If you don't remember that, go back and look at Rydberg. So wavelengths are much bigger than atomic sizes, typically. At least for visible light. So we have some electromagnetic plane wave going by our atom. It has a spatial dependence that goes like e to the k dot r. So if the wavelength is much bigger than the size of the atom, over the size of the atom, this is can be approximated by 1. So that means we can write the electric field of a plane wave going through our atom as an amplitude times cos omega t, and we'll choose the electric field in the z direction because everyone knows electric fields always point in the z direction. The direction of the electric field tells us where how we're going to align our coordinate system, and we like to choose z in that direction. So now we know the form of the perturbation that we're interested in. So a perturbation Hamiltonian is charge times electric field. So when we look at the matrix elements between particular states A and B, the only thing that the wave functions, the only thing that varies over the wave functions is z. These guys just depend on position. So the charge and the magnitude of the electric field and the time-dependent oscillation are just come out of the side of the integral. And these things we saw before. Some dipole moment. So when we did the Stark effect, we put our hydrogen atom in a constant electric field, and the perturbations we found depended on these matrix elements. It wasn't that long ago. And the other clever thing we noticed was that our wave functions were either even or odd under parity. So if we take all the coordinates to minus themselves, the wave functions either went back to themselves or went back to themselves times the minus 1. But that means we saw that psi squared is always even. And z is odd when z goes to minus z. So that means all the diagonal matrix elements are 0. So these random assumptions that we've been making today actually are useful when we consider light interacting with patterns. Oh, we've still got time. So all we have to do is look at our systems, which is matrix element, which is its dipole moment matrix element, times the magnitude, we called it E0, of the electric field, which is the magnitude of the amplitude in the plane wave that's going through. And we already solved this with this sinusoidal type perturbation. So what can happen? We could have a photon coming in, and we start in the lower state EA, and can go up to EB. Or we can start in EB and go down to EA. So then we have two photons. So we had the photon that was coming in, it tickled our electron, the electron went down to the lower energy state, it had to release energy. And so that energy comes out as another photon. And the third possibility is we're just sitting in the top state and we go down to the bottom state and emit a photon. that one seems a little weird. We'll come back to that. So this is called absorption. This is called stimulated emission. This is called spontaneous emission. And we've already worked out what the probability for these things to happen. Probability to go from A to B. Plugging into our previous formula. So it depends on that dipole moment, matrix element, and the strength of the electric field. This one stimulated emission, P going back to A, just the same it was Einstein who realized that. So this is what you use to make a laser. So if you can pump up your atoms so they're in an excited state, a single photon at the resonant frequency going through will produce two photons, and they'll have the same frequency. And then these guys can hit more atoms and release more photons all at the same frequency. So that's light amplification by stimulated emission. Now what about this guy? So electromagnetic fields are sort of you can think of electromagnetic fields as little quantum harmonic oscillators. The strength of the electromagnetic field at each point in space is like a harmonic oscillator. Harmonic oscillators, we know, have some zero-point energy. So even at the lowest energy state is that there's some energy in the electromagnetic field. So you can think of this as being that ground state energy of the electromagnetic field, which you would say there's no photon there because it's just empty space. But empty space has some ground state energy. So that the energy in that ground state is what's causing, you can think of that as what's causing this transition. So up to now we've pretended that all the energy levels of hydrogen lasted forever because they were energy eigenstates. But when you take into account that there's electromagnetic fields, through all of space, the excited states will decay to the lower states. Eventually, there's not, if you're not pumping more energy in, they'll end up in the ground state. So that means you can actually have transitions. And that means we can see things. Any questions? So the solutions to this homework will be posted on the website. You guys know how to find the solutions. So they're not there yet, but the grader promised to give me the solutions this morning. So they'll be up today, and we'll have our review session at 3.
The review session is 4:32?
Yeah.
Alex.
I just need coffee. I'll go get coffee. Hold on.
No problem.